Hello, I'm Simon Burton, and welcome to a Christmas edition of Arts Roundup, where we'll hobnob with the latest royal portrait artists, find out how to pack a sexy and political punch with a striking kimono, and then some, and drop in on art students discovering their talents and realising a creative dream. In this edition, award-winning royal portrait artist Dan Llewellyn Hall visits Cambridge and talks on his latest work. Cambridge School of Visual and Performing Arts opens new studios in King Street and gives 105 a taster of its cutting-edge drama, art and design courses. Freelance painter and teacher Deanna Tyson talks on her current exhibition of kimono artworks, which carry multi-layered and thought-provoking socio-economic themes. And Cambridge artist Chloe Leeper previews her January show and invites people to watch her work in Norfolk Street over Christmas. It's not often you meet a rising star on the national contemporary art scene, but anything can happen when you visit the house of Cambridge journalist and author Anne Garvey. A spontaneous private view of 37 paintings drew in an eager audience to see the highly colourful and much talked about work of Dan Llewellyn Hall, a 33-year-old painter from Cardiff who was recently commissioned to do a striking portrait of the Queen and was Young Artist of the Year in 2003. He's loosely regarded as part of a visionary lineage of painters dating back to the dreams of the Romantics, and has a rare talent for capturing the atmosphere of bright imagined places based on emotional memories of uplifting settings. Dan talked about his work, which includes landscapes inspired by experiences in Crete, France and the Canary Islands, and abstracts as well as portraiture. His portraits have a way of capturing the subject's spirit in a semi-caricature, which emanates from the true rendition of the subject's eyes, and he was much acclaimed for his work of World War II veteran Harry Patch, which won him the BT Portrait Award. Dan includes all kinds of unlikely things in his abstract paintings that aren't easy to spot, and he makes jokes alluding to other painters such as Van Gogh, and includes modern miracles like wind turbines marking the current era.
The portrait of Harry Patch was something actually I pursued because I was very keen. I'd read a book actually at the point in time, The Last 20 Veterans of the First World War, and I sort of made the approach myself, and after a couple of years of the process, I finally got to meet Harry Patch. That was a tremendously privileged position to make it. Actually.
And with your portraits, I mean, you seem to sort of hover between basically trying to capture an established adult presence within the figure, but also elements of a caricature in it as well, and particularly focusing on the eyes. What's the secret to one of your portraits? How did they come about?
Well, I like to build in the whole notion of, you know, humour and things. I think people shy away from humour when it comes to portraiture, and particularly of big subject matters like, you know, the First World War veterans, people like that, and people like the Queen and so forth. And people, you know, that people are overwhelmed by that as a subject matter. But for me, I like to sort of get really down to the nugget of the sense of humour and the fun which some of these people have.
Now, you obviously did this portrait of the Queen, which has been much talked about. You had her for something like an hour or so. Was that enough time to actually get to know the Queen a little bit, and what is she like at close quarters when you're doing a project like that?
Yeah, I think it was enough time for me because she's somebody who you know, disarms you and makes you feel very much at ease very quickly, and is very conversable, and, you know, a great conversationist. But so for me, it was very easy to do that portrait because, you know, I'd already set out with the idea of what I was going to do for it. She's great fun, actually.
Why do you think they picked you to do that one?
Well, because actually it was really a bit of a lineage through the portraits I'd done previously. So it was to do with the Harry Patch portrait that the Queen had acquired two of my drawings, the studies for the Harry Patch. And it happened that the Welsh Rugby Union also were looking for someone to commission for the portrait. And they'd owned a portrait of me as well. So it was a bit of serendipity in that sense. Really.
You've been doing recent work. Obviously, we're looking at a selection of your paintings here at Anne Garvey's house in Cambridge. You've been doing work which is based on some of your travels in Greece, France and Canary Islands. Tell me a bit about that. How did this recent work come about?
I was very interested in the idea of the resort. And for the British people, we're all very familiar with resorts as we go on holiday. But they're normally culturally bankrupt places which we don't really have any sense of engagement with the history of a place. So for me, I wanted to get... I was searching out places which had this sort of sense of escapism, really, try to unveil that.
Yeah, I mean, I very much got that sense that hedonism, escapism and uplifting moments are very much what's behind your art. Is that really important for you? Because you're both a sort of semi-visionary and also romantic figure in some senses in terms of the way that you paint, aren't you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I would say that for me, because you feel as though you're at the root of it, particularly when you go to these resorts. For me, they appeal to me enormously because they're uncharted territories. For an artist, that's exactly what you want. You want to reveal imagery history and create and add give something new, fresh to the table. Really.
Now you received that in a kind of an emotional way, but you actually put a lot of very exacting work into those landscapes, don't you? How long does it take to produce a piece like
I would say,
you're showing this evening?
I should imagine on average. I mean, I sit in front of the things. I like to immerse myself in the subject, so I never work from photographs or anything second source. I would say each picture, on average, I should think, would take me probably, you know, over the course of 2 or 3 days whilst I'm there on the subject, and I don't really do much more than that, in fact.
What has to be there for you to say, actually, that work is finished?
Well, it's just connecting with the imagery with the feeling. So as soon as you start feeling what you felt when you're originally there and what you're looking at, and you get back to that feeling, the originality of it, then you feel as though you've got a complete picture, really. Sort of,
how did you become associated with Angabi? Where does that link come in? How did you end up being...
So I was here actually for an engagement party of a good friend of mine, a writer, Owen Shears, and we met on this one occasion, and Anne very kindly suggested doing it, and I liked the room very much, but I'd never not really been to Cambridge, and I thought it was a bit of an adventure, really.
Been working on film sets and film projects as well, hadn't you, recently?
Yeah, well, I've been very fortunate to be invited to go to different sort of environments like that, you know, follow a film crew, but I like to engage with the actual subject matter and the people who are there, rather than the film itself. So it's really about the whole dialogue of how films are made, which is something we really get to see.
Who are your main influences? Who do you draw upon, both past and presently at the moment?
There's an endless list, but yeah. I suppose that people always stay at the top for me, at the deceased artists, really, because, I mean, they've got enough time elapsed too, so you can get a better perspective on them. But people like Soutine is someone I always return to, an expressionist painter. Matisse, of course, is someone I've always got a great, great sort of empathy with. I believe that his sort of vision and his approach was exacting to what mine is. So I'd say they're two very fundamental, but I could reel off many, many names, and in fact it's a very, very hard thing to do, because every painting's got a different touch of somebody else.
I'm here, obviously, we're at a private view, but when is your next major exhibition coming up?
Well, I'm now, next year, I'm just devoting the whole year really to working on the centenary, an exhibition to commemorate the centenary of Dylan Thomas's 100th anniversary. So it's going to be a series of exhibitions in London and in Wales, and I'm going to be responding to his short stories, in fact. I've chosen his prose work. So we have a programme of things to do with that. So.
Very exciting work. Dan Lennon-Hall, thank you very much indeed for talking to me.
Thanks, Simon.
Here, some buffs educated me on the contents of a complex abstract that you really need to study closely. You're going to say there's something extraordinary about this painting.
Well, there is, because there's I'd say a fairly abstract piece of work, but there's one clear figurative element within it. It's just a question of finding it.
Well, there are two.
If you regard the dog.
If you use your imagination, and the other one is purely illustrative.
And whimsical.
Is it the dog's head?
Not the dog's head, no. Nor the horse's head, whatever you might think.
Whatever it might be, but to the right of the painting is something else. Third of the way down.
It's a elongated grey shape, or possibly taking off. It's entirely whimsical.
Yeah.
Oh, no, not entirely whimsical. On the right.
Oh, it's a jet, obviously.
Yes, yeah. But what jet is it?
It's a Concorde.
Yeah, it is, and it is.
But it doesn't have a drooping nose.
But Dan tells me he actually painted this when he was working at Harrow, which is where I work. And he was in... There's a lovely sort of copse on the site of the school, and a lovely lake and things. And he was walking there, and he saw that. It was the last time the Concorde flew, and we're right underneath the flight path, so he managed to see it, and he worked it into this otherwise entirely fantastical painting.
Wanting to set the world on fire at a young age seems to be every teenager's dream these days, and choosing the right training at 16 plus can be vital, especially if you set your heart on acting, performing arts, music, or art and design. Converting raw energy and talent in ambitious and creative youngsters into a fighting chance to win a place at a top UK college or firm is a service now highly sought after. I've been hearing about the range of courses offered at the Cambridge School of Visual and Performing Arts as it moves into a new and impressive premises in King Street, noticeably displaying the latest chic clothing designs and artworks in the shopfront besides Darry's restaurant. Established in 1985, the college originally only ran courses in Art and Design Foundation, but has now broadened its portfolio to include a BA in Graphics, Illustration and Design, and Performing Arts Foundations as demand rockets. Active prestigious partnerships with RADA, Kingston University and the University of Arts London are attracting students with the promise of intensive teaching and top-notch connections. Drum students can be strange creatures to encounter, as I found out in their spacious new studios. No shortage of youthful exuberance here, with a course which students really felt was furnishing them with the right acting, singing and dance skills, and masterclasses linked to RADA. Here's Acting Foundation student Tanwin Smith-Meek.
This college has some pretty prestigious connections, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It was actually RADA's original foundation course. I think it's the oldest one out of all the drama school foundation courses, and it's been going for about 10 years. RADA established their own foundation afterwards, but the union has been going for quite a while.
Does that enable you to actually go to RADA to some of their workshops and even have lectures possibly by some of the famous names there?
Yeah, well, we haven't had lectures yet, but in our first week we went and had talks with Nona Shepherd, who's one of the main directors there, and she also makes the final decisions in the auditions. We've also been to see a couple of plays, and we had Brian Sterner who come in, who's used to be a very successful actor, and he's on the RADA board. And we also had, and I think we have Nona Shepherd coming in the future as well, so there is quite a lot of...
Is that where you personally are heading for, RADA, if you pass out of here with your foundation course qualification?
Well, that would be the dream, definitely. But I mean, any of the top drama schools would be ideal, but RADA, I suppose, would be the dream. That's the one that everyone...
What attracted you to this particular college in the first place?
I actually found out about it because a friend of mine who's also from Norwich did the course, and she is at RADA now, and she's in her second year, and she recommended it to me and said that she attributed her success to doing this course, so that's what the main thing that attracted me to it.
And the course itself, is it pretty dynamic? What do you learn how to do? Presumably you're doing singing, dancing and acting.
Yeah, we do pretty much everything you could want from a foundation course. Obviously we have acting classes, we have movement classes, we do dancing, singing, and it's all about what we really learn is that all means of art are kind of about expressing yourself. So whether it's singing, whether it's dance, whether it's acting, it's all about kind of expressing yourself through that medium.
And what have been the high points of the course so far? How many people are in your group?
We have two groups of, there's one group of 9, one group of 10, and 4 musical theatre students. I think the highlights have been, the things we've been working towards, such as the RADA Shakespeare certificate, which is where they have an examiner from RADA come in and we had to do a duologue. I did the monologue exam as well. So we had to perform a monologue and a sonnet and a scene and then get a sight reading as well. And then we haven't had the results in yet, but they'll be sent in probably, I think, next month. Well, the Christmas show was one of the big highlights, where it was basically an accumulation of everything we've learned so far this term. So we did, obviously acting, singing and dancing. And what's great about that is that there are things like dance, which I struggled with quite a lot to begin with. And it was something that I kind of wasn't sure if I could do, but now, and then I ended up doing the dance ensemble in the show and singing in front of people as well. And these are both things that would have made me nervous before, but it was great to just be able to actually, as I said, express myself through other means other than acting.
Which areas do you think you've really improved on?
I think my movement. I used to be, because I did karate for a lot of years before I came here, and I think that made me, I had quite a stiff, because it had been quite a stiff body because it was drilled into me. And the movement and dance classes really helped me to kind of become more in tune with my body, so it wasn't just about acting through my voice, but to actually free myself up physically. I think that's one of the main areas improved, and also just general confidence and focus.
Francesca Oldham says the expansion of the school into King Street enables them to provide state-of-the-art new facilities.
So we've just got some new facilities at King Street. We were growing, and the demand is ever-growing, so we needed a bit more space, and it's actually quite interesting how we came across that piece of property. One of our tutors is a practicing artist, and he's actually in residence at Christ College upstairs in the studios, and he obviously let us know about that space, and We held a catwalk fashion show there last summer and thought, really exciting, definitely a really interesting space for us. So, and we actually got told about the space at King Street by Izam Kubaj, who's worked with us in the college for 20 years, but he's actually quite a famous local artist, practicing artist. He was actually, his work was given as a gift to Prince William and Kate when they came to Cambridge. So yeah, so he let us know about this space because he's Christ College in residence artist upstairs. So yeah, we moved there and it's a really interesting space for us. There's, you know, we saw so much potential there. So
there's a large sphere hanging in the window, which is made of entirely of cloth butterflies of all kinds of different colours. Whose was that one wonderful piece of artwork?
Not entirely sure whose that is, but it? Within the window, at the moment, we have a tradition where we display staff work during the two-week Christmas break, just purely because it's a great way to show students that all our tutors are practicing artists and, you know, they're interested in what their teachers are doing. So it's a sort of tradition that we do this every year. People are very interested in what we're doing here because we're based on more of a sort of a different model to what modern art institutions are based on. We're very into sort of the older ways of a practicing art school. We are just dedicated to art and design. There's no other, in terms of BAs and things, there's no other BAs here. It's very much an art and design school, and all our teachers, and it's very hands-on, lots of teacher contact time, very personalized projects where students are doing very individual things. There's no group tasks. I mean, our approach to learning is, it's got to be unique and it's got to be personalised. It's all about one-on-one time with the teacher. There is constantly teachers here for students to access and they're taught 40 hours a week, every week. So it's, you know, it's quite, in that way, a different model to a lot of modern art institutions. It's like I say, it's really based on this, you know, learn from your teacher, real individual guidance. So that in itself is very interesting. And on top of that, we provide, like I say, a Mac and workspace for every graphics and illustration student, a mannequin and workspace, and unlimited amounts of calico for all our fashion design students. And, you know, of course, there's always study skill support for things like essays. We have a whole department dedicated to that. So all the facilities that students need to get those top marks to really prepare them.
Kenneth Gardner is studying a BA in graphic design and illustration and says the course are intensive and encourage individual innovation.
So far, it's been great. Like, I would say the biggest difference, the thing is, one for us, like, since the school is a lot smaller, and one thing that's definitely been a benefit to him, I have more one-on-one time with my teachers, which is really great, because then that way I have more kind of like hands-on with my work as well. And of course, you're more encouraged to try different things and experiment, which I think really has helped me out in my work.
Can you tell me about your particular project? What does it involve?
Currently, right now, we're just doing like a small animation, which we have to finish from when we come back from Christmas. And I've never did animation before, but it's been really fun because I enjoy learning about new different mediums and stuff and anything. And even though if I may never touch animation again, it's still really good to just kind of learn something different, because you can always apply stuff like that to your other work as well.
What are your ambitions when you finish the course? What are you hoping to go on and do?
That's the tricky one, because I think it happens for a good bit of students when you come out here. You always wanted to do with like one field. Like, I wanted to head in like concept art and stuff and video games and everything. But then when I came out here, it's like, we've been meeting people coming from different publishers and stuff, whatever, and I'm like, oh, I can get into publishing now, I can do children's books, or you can even self-publish now thanks to like stuff like the internet and Kickstarter. So I honestly don't know at this point, because it's just so many options that's just kind of been brought to light. But if anything, I'll probably try and head into more publishing, because I really want people to kind of view and enjoy my work, if anything else.
The fashion sector's recent success stories have been a shot in the arm.
At our fashion design, on our fashion BA fashion design, the catwalk show, we actually had a scout come and they saw some work, a student's work, and offered them on the spot a place on their MA at London College of Fashion in menswear, which is, you know, really highly sought after place. So, you know, there's some really exciting things that happen like that. I mean, we have students on our graphics and illustrations course who did internships at Saatchi & Saatchi and now working in, you know, a big advertising company in New York. We've got some really exciting stuff. And, you know, we've got lots of visiting speakers and practicing artists coming to talk, because people are interested in what's happening here. It's different. It's a bit unusual, and people are, you know, excited.
Here's Alexis Solston, a third-year fashion design student, busily working on an end-of-course collection.
I noticed there's lots of wonderful things involving fashion going on around this building.
Yes.
There's fashion photography, making clothing and things like that. What do you do yourself?
We're part of the department. I'm in the department of where we essentially construct garments.
Mm-hmm. And that starts off, I mean, can you tell me a bit how project works? You start off basically with a drawing, don't you?
Essentially, well, here with the school, they want you to first learn about the development and what's going on around the world in a fashion way, and then to start developing and then kind of come up with your own idea using the inspiration that you have, and then through that you start designing, and then from the design you start making.
And what resources do you have at your disposal here for that?
Actually, we're lucky in that respect. We have a lot, and must say that it's, you know, being here studying in Cambridge, essentially what is a private college with the affiliation of Kingston, we're lucky.
Can you tell me about your particular project? What does it involve and what was the outcome?
Well, at the moment, as I'm in my third year, we have to make a collection. So it's essentially, for me, I'm using my background, as in my life story essentially, and the countries which I've lived in, and incorporating that with sport. So British tailoring and the colours of South America. So these are places which I've lived in, and I want to kind of bring them together in a kind of collaboration.
And where do you want to take your skills, as it were, when you finish the course?
Well, that was an interesting, it's only some recent kind of spark of idea, which is to essentially, I would like to see if I can get into Savile Row and do bespoke tailoring there.
Yeah.
And that's where I'd like to continue my work, because it's always been the tailoring.
And what about catwalk shows? Did you do that?
Yeah, first year, second year, and even third year as well, which is we're going to present in London during London Fashion Week.
Yeah.
So that would be an opportunity for us and to essentially exhibit our work to the greater public.
And has this been a very exciting and expensive course for you to do?
It has been. It's one of the most expensive courses to do. But it is, I think, I'm lucky to be able to do it as well. And I think, you know, with the opportunity given, it's a great opportunity to take. Here, one thing that we're also very lucky with is the contact time that we have with our tutors. We're essentially something which is Jane, the head of department, has thought through and thought is the best way of actually being taught, is to be here, you know, every day for the period of the day, essentially, to learn. And so we're very lucky with that. And being a small group, and this is why, for me, it was a huge attraction to come here, because of it's very small groups, which means you can get a lot of contact time. It helps a lot. And we get taught how to make the garments as well. So we learn from the basic sewing throughout the years, you know, and that's how we do. You know, at the end, for us, we have to present, as third years now in January, at the end of January, we have to present toiles, essentially, which is in calico, a whole collection, and that we have to assemble.
Well, high hopes are one thing, but results are everything. And former drama students are now hitting the stage in the West End and are due to perform later this year in Cambridge.
We've got two students, Jonathan Sayer and Charlie Russell, who went on to Lambda. And they've actually written and are performing their own play, The Play That Goes Wrong. And it's in the West End at the moment, and it's up for a Best Comedy Award. And I'm pleased to say that's actually coming to the Cambridge Arts Theatre in May. So that's a really exciting opportunity. And, you know, we've had a local boy called Tom Bailey, who actually, he was a local boy from Hills Road, and he got a place at Bristol Old Vic, and, you know, 3,000 people apply there every year, and only 16 get selected, so it's a really prestigious school. Yeah, so we've got some real success stories from drama as well.
Francesca Oldham, what a fantastic platform for a career in the arts. What a fabulous college. Thank you very much indeed for showing me around.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.
Slipping into a silk-lined kimono in a relaxing personal space can be a highly appetising idea, and not to mention a bit sexy too. Tempting people towards the more pleasant side of humanity isn't hard, but getting people to look and engage with the darker side of the truth about humanity and the corruption and suffering around us is often a difficult nut to crack. I've been talking to an artist who's currently exhibiting over 100 thought-provoking works on socio-political themes in the spacious new Alison Richards building in West Road. Freelance painter, textile artist and teacher Deanna Tyson's banners and silk-lined kimonos pack plenty of political punch in a dazzling array of brightly coloured works, many of which you could wear just like your principals over a mortal and vulnerable body. Deanna is a fellow of the Royal College of Arts and works with textiles because they're a truly worldwide and universal street and carnival form that lend themselves as dynamic canvases for portraying conflicts and injustice issues in every part of the globe. We're in the choral stairwell of the Alison Richards building, a wonderful new Cambridge University building, loads of exhibition space, and you've used a large amount of it. How many pieces have you got on display here, hanging from the balconies and from the walls? And
I've got well over 100 pieces, and they span a period of time, but what's been fabulous for me is, because I work on a kind of political theme and socio-political themes, I've been able to put work in here that's related to the different areas being taught. So here there's politics, Latin American studies, South Asian studies and African studies. And I've tried to relate work to each of those areas on each floor. Yeah.
When did you first fall in love with kimonos? Was that an exotic trip abroad that brought those into your life?
No. I've always loved political cartoons, and I've always loved Japanese line woodblock prints. There's a beautiful movement of line there that I've always responded to. And it wasn't until I was living in the Netherlands and I came back to England, read an article in a newspaper, and it related to a little park in the middle of Tokyo, which was going to be dug up because a recreation centre was going to be built. And when they dug the recreation centre, they realised that underneath that, it was the site of a concentration camp that had carried out hideous medical procedures. And to me, that just kind of clicked. Actually, that's what I felt. I mean, it sounds awful, but that's what I felt about a lot of societies, particularly Japan, that there are two extremes operating there. And the art specifically showed that to me. You have beauty and you have a dark side.
They do reflect, don't they, kimonos, relaxation, personal space, and obviously also they're sexy as well, aren't they?
Oh, yes.
So it's kind of like wearing everything that you think and believe in.
I have kimonos that aren't here, which are much more sexy. Yeah. But it is to do with, you know, you wearing the world. It's a part of you and a part of your surroundings. It's not an isolated piece of work on the wall.
They're absolutely beautiful. And the banners, where did they originate from?
That was because I absolutely I've always wanted to do a piece of work on Rainbow Nation, the idea of the Rainbow Nation. And I love wax cloths because they're over the top, because they're incredibly bright. So I've collected fabrics from Ghana and Senegal, and people have given me fabrics from Congo, and I selected them. They're actually quite intricate to make, but they're selected on the basis of colours.
Mm-hmm.
Well, red, orange, yellow, everything like that, but also characters that I put to that, because I find African society incredibly vibrant and creative. So I've put the positive figures from Africa on each banner.
Mm-hmm.
So you have dance, sport, music, creativity in terms of fashion and art and all of those kind of things. There are a couple of negatives there. I have got the military on there and corrupt politicians, but in general, very positive, and industry is women. This kimono is called the Judas tree.
Yes.
I have Greek friends, and the state of Greek, emotionally as well as economically at the moment, is dreadful. And when I last went to Greece, it was before I did this kimono, I've actually been since, the Judas trees, which are very, very beautiful trees, were in blossom all over. I also made a visit to the Oracle at Delphi, and I suddenly thought, actually, there's a kind of a comparison to be made between what's happening in Greece, being forced to choose between going independent and staying part of the EU, and the fact that if you went to the Oracle at Delphi, you could choose a path, but you weren't actually ever given any help. And I mean, I know that sounds an odd comparison, but for me it was very real. And if you speak to Greeks, they will see the Olympic Games as one of the starts of their downfall. And also, they are very upset by the German attitude towards Greece, because a lot of the infrastructure, wonderful though it is provided by Germany. And Germany knew the state of Greek economy. They knew the level of money that they had before they started lending them all of this money. And for me, it's a bit like the arms race. If you provide somebody with arms, you can't blame them entirely for using them. You're responsible. So for me, the EU, and particularly Germany, are responsible for what's happened there.
It's a beautifully large, bright kimono with some of those Greek blues and whites that you always associate with Greece, but you've also got nooses as if from a gallows going down the side of them. What are those representing? Exactly?
Yeah, well, it's a two-layered kimono, so the top layer is a Judas tree itself, but the nooses represent everything that the Greeks feel that they have lost, and I asked Greek friends to write, and they wrote very eloquently. So they've lost optimism, they've lost faith in the future, they've lost education, they've lost Greeks love being hospitable, and they can't afford to do that. They've lost the family unity. They've lost so many things. And a lot of them are committing suicide. So it was that idea of... You know, and also there's a reference to the Judas tree being called a Judas tree because Judas was supposed to have committed suicide on it. So I just link all of those things together.
So it's despair in a very bright and wonderful place.
It is totally... It's despair in a beautiful place, yes. Yeah. And the underlayer with all of the graffiti, that layer is to do with the Greek cry has always been education... bread and I've forgotten the third and democracy that you know those are the three things they'll always cry out for, and that's what they feel that they're losing. And yes, and so it was lovely working with Greek people who gave me their information. So written on the inside here is the letter that Tatika wrote to me about all of the losses and how people felt and how they can't be hospitable anymore. And this is a Greek family flag. And this is a flag from one of the protests. So I collect things together. People give me them, which is brilliant.
OK, we've got two wonderful exhibits here on the ground floor, one in a glass case, which looks at first glance like a bag, but it has many things on it, like bullet cartridges and things like that. And then on the wall behind, we have a piece called Flight from Goma. Where did those two come from?
They came from the conflict in the Congo. Laurent Nkunda was one of the really vicious warlords in the east of Congo. And he was one of the gentlemen who was very prevalent in producing child soldiers. And as his badge shows, he's a rebel for Christ, which is he's probably one of the most unchristian people you can come across. The bag is also to do with Congo in that it's to do with exploitation. To me, a Louis Vuitton bag is a completely over-the-top waste of time. And I've but it's in order to own one of those, you have to be very wealthy or you have a fake. Now, the wealth for me of the Congo is what's producing the ability to certain people in the world to have these over-the-top possessions. So, actually, the bag is made of it's a second-hand Oxfam coat, really. And if you see the lighter areas on the edges, which are on a Louis Vuitton bag, they're actually made out of pornographic magazines. And they're to do with the idea of, what kind of things result from this exploitation. You'll see diamonds around there because obviously they're removed from the Congo. You'll see the symbols of the Louis Vuitton have been replaced by landmines and the machine gun cartridges and hand grenades. So I've converted those symbols. And if you look inside, you're looking into a mine and you can see the eyes of the miners in there. So it's to do with, you take everything out and you give them nothing but war.
Yeah.
And conflict.
This is just one of massive kimono. What a fantastically interesting story. And thank you very much indeed for sharing this with me.
Well, thank you for coming and interviewing me.
That's great.
You're listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.
If you're walking anywhere near Norfolk Street over the Christmas period, it's worth taking a peek at the sculpture busily at work through the ice cube window of Changing Spaces as she gradually assembles a new structure set to open in January. Chloe Leeper is painstakingly creating The Glass Project Part 2 that looks at the hinterland between abstract reality and the way we see the concrete world, seen perhaps through the gossamer of a kind of waking dream that breaks the rules of perception. Here we are in the Changing Places studio, which is right next to the CBT Cafe. I talked to you a few weeks ago about the amazing thing that you did in this ice cube-shaped shop window, but you're just building up to doing something else. What are you up to at the moment?
Yeah, well, following the first project, Angie invited me back to do a part two because the system worked very well and a lot of the public really enjoyed the fact that they got to, I had a lot of good feedback that they got to see the build. So this time, I've taken the opportunity to use an existing piece that I made a couple of years ago in London, which was exploring, again, spatial perception, but this time in a much more transitory nature. And whereas before I had it as a corner piece, so you could only look at it, this time I've used the whole gallery space, so you walk into it, so it becomes an immersive installation.
Connotations of Ariadne's web around us.
Definitely. There is a web-like... It's all to do with this fractured notion of spatial perception, I think. I'm really interested in the fact that actually there are lots of systems in place to try and make space very comprehensible and very total, and particularly architectural space. And I've always found that actually perception, visual perception in particular, and especially acoustic perception, because a lot of this is very influenced by musical spatial structuring, is that... what happens is that you take in moment by moment, you build up a schematic in your mind, but actually it's very fractured. So this piece is full of delicate little moments, murmurings. It's based on, not based on, but it takes some of the kind of poetic language of Eve Lomax's book, Sounding the Event, and she talks about the noisy multiplicity of the world.
Are you exploiting that sort of characteristic of the mind, that when it sees something, it can sometimes fill in the rest of the pictures, what they call posing in animation, things like that? And you're playing with that a little bit, are you?
Definitely. In fact, you'll see there's deliberately broken squares, because a lot of this, again, because of framing and focusing on areas, was to do with this notion of typical framing of spaces, which we often do in rectilinear forms. So I've taken the square as a motif related to some of the parts of the actual architecture and kind of surface skin texture of the gallery. But I like the fact of that incompleteness because of the very fact that we're so conditioned to complete things and allow things to fit into existing schematics. Or schemas, rather, that I want to distort that slightly.
It looks like a very painstaking project because you're using tiny, almost invisible threads to suspend things in the air. And where do you get that from? Is that fishing line or something?
It is. It's a really basic... It's not even fishing line strength. It's a really basic transparent thread. Yes, it's very... fiddly, which is not at all like me for anyone that knows me. I'm very heavy-handed. But it was sort of necessary. It was one of these things where the language had to be this kind of ephemeral, delicate, transitory, fragile, in order to get over the idea. Anything too heavy became too much about the form, and this has to stay about the space rather than the objects within the space.
You've got kind of what seems to be like dust or charcoal onto white walls, but you're playing a little bit between whether or not something is a smudge or is it something more interesting. And that's great because you have specific things laid into that. What are you trying to do there exactly?
Well, in a similar way to the last piece, and that's why it is a continuation of this constantly playing between three-dimensional real space as such and two-dimensional illusionistic space. And so a lot of this smudgy language and the linear work, it's not influence as such, but I've recently seen Chinese apparitional painting, and again that kind of that trying to get a metaphysical space beyond the silk or beyond the paper. It's my similar way of going in the wall, and it sort of oscillates between very much surface texture and then a kind of perceived depth that goes through the wall. So
People can actually watch you gradually creating this art space. They drop in and say things to you.
I have a few sort of regular people who every day will walk by and sort of thumbs up, and they're people I recognise from the last installation. So I started to build up some sort of weirdly, I don't know, visual relationships with people. And other people will stop, read the, there's a bit of blurb on the window so you understand it, but people do stop for quite a while. And then, like I found last time, I wasn't really that aware because I'm quite concentrated in what I'm doing. But the number of people who came to the show and said, I've been watching and I've really enjoyed that, people must be engaging with it.
When is this one going to open to the public?
This is going to be open on the 4th from 12 o'clock, and the private view is that night, and everybody is invited. Again, we're being sponsored private views drinks by CB2 very kindly, so there will be some nice alcohol and soft drinks, and that will run till the 12th.
And Chloe Leeper, another really exciting one coming up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's time to take a look at what's coming up in the city in the coming weeks. If you're listening to the rerun of the show in early January, this will be out of date.
Moscow City Ballet does Swan Lake at the Corn Exchange on Friday the 3rd of January and the Nutcracker on the Saturday the 4th and Sunday the 5th at the same venue. Agatha Christie's Black Coffee opens at the Arts Theatre on January the 20th. The Arts Theatre pantomime Robin Hood runs until the 12th of January, directed by Michael Fentiman. And on Monday the 23rd of December, there's a family Christmas concert at the Corn Exchange with Cambridgeshire County Council Youth Orchestra. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I hope you've enjoyed a creative hour with us on Cambridge 105 FM. I'm Simon Burton, and I wish you a Merry Christmas.